good day, everybody. This is Patricia Corey, and you've tuned in to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that dares you, implores you to think outside the box of convention and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. And I start the show a bit disturbed by something that leads right into what I'll be talking about with my guest David Irving today. I just saw something on Facebook that I want to share with you. Two punks, young guys, 18 years old, smiling for the camera, holding a little puppy with a rope around its neck that they just killed by hanging it, and laughing about that. And it really gets me down, not into despair, but it's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable, the human capacity for cruelty. And so today we're going to be talking about that. And if you've got a weak stomach and you don't want to hear about it, this might not be the program for you, because I'm going to ask my guest to tell us a little bit more about what's happening to the animals on the farms and help to drive this message home. And it hurts me to hear it. As an animal activist for so many years, we have to keep bringing this message out so that less people will be interested in hurting animals for sport. And with that, I would like to thank and introduce my guest today. His name is David Giroux Irving, and his book just came across my desk. It's called The Protein Myth, and it's a profound examination of the human dependence on meat, dairy, and what that's doing to us as human beings, and what that's doing to the animals. So I'd like to welcome him. Hi, David.
Hi, Patricia. Thanks very much for having me here, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. I really haven't read the whole book. It's very intense, but it's just right up my alley, since I am an animal activist and a vegetarian of 28 years. And I think everybody needs to read this book and get involved. So I'm going to ask you, I've got a lot of questions for you, but I think, as I read, you were an accomplished musician. You're an interesting man. Graduated magna cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, in music.
That's right. That's my primary. That's what I originally started out to do, and turning to writing came on later on in life.
Although, yeah, it's the same with me. Yeah, well, you are a wonderful writer, too, so thank you for finding the additional creative flow to bring this book to life.
Okay. Thank you.
How did you come to write this? What is the motivation? How did you get involved in writing this book? Obviously, you, too, are an animal activist, and I'd like to have a little bit of information about how you got into this. How you took us on this path of this book.
Okay. Well, it goes back a few years, all the way back to 1998. And that's when a very close friend phoned me and told me she had just been diagnosed with breast cancer. And her mother had breast cancer, and her mother died of the disease. And my friend, too, would die of the disease. And, you know, when this happens, it's a hard thing to know how to handle. You want to be supportive of your friend, and you do that as best you can. You help out however you can, but you're kind of helpless, and you're controlled by this disease that's just kind of dangling you like a little puppet on strings. And then fast forward about 10 years to 2008, and another close friend called me and told me that she had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And I thought, uh-oh, here we go again. Yeah. But fortunately, she has survived and she's doing very well. But everyone isn't so fortunate, like my friend. And a lot of women are getting breast cancer and they're dying from the disease. A close friend of mine told me that his daughter had been diagnosed with breast cancer and she died 3 weeks later. They caught it so late. So it's just this tragedy of these killer diseases. And about 3 days after my friend called me in 2008, I was watching TV, and I clicked on PBS, and a man was talking there by the name of T. Colin Campbell. He turns out to be one of the top scientists in the world in the field of epidemiology, his field. And he was talking about how breast cancer, right at that very moment I tuned in, he was talking about how breast cancer, the risk of getting this disease could be vastly reduced. And the key to doing that was to stop consuming animal protein. Not only breast cancer, but several other forms of cancer, and also diabetes and also stroke and many of our chronic conditions, they could all be eliminated if we just stopped consuming animal protein. And so that woke me up fast because, as you indicated, you're a vegan and I'm a vegan, and I've been a vegan since about 1985, and here I've been protected from these diseases all this time. I didn't even know it. But that was not the primary reason for me becoming a vegan, which was concern for the way that animals are treated. But what got me most, if I just one more point about this, what got me most about this was the realization that while a vast number of millions of women could be protected from getting breast cancer, why this information was not getting out to the public. Why were our healthcare organizations not revealing this information to the public and ignoring it? And that really
because they've got the lobby from the industries that produce this food blocking any kind of public awareness campaign, right? We have to agree that the Food and Drug Administration is not working in the best interest of human beings.
That's
Would you
right.
agree with that?
That's right. Hello?
So you bring forward in the book details of how eating meat directly affects the body for these diseases?
What I go into in the book is divided into two parts. And, you know, from the standpoint of animal rights, there are two sides working to promote animal rights. One is nutrition, like if we don't consume animals, then that's in favor of the animals. And the other is how it affects the world, how consuming a plant-based diet affects the world. So the book is divided into two parts. In the first part, I go into how we can prevent getting these killer diseases, how the healthcare organizations are not doing their job in communicating this information, and the myth that exists about the need for consuming animal protein. And in the second half of the book, then I go into what the effects are on our planet from consuming a meat-based diet.
Yeah, and of course, one of the subjects of relative to that, which I think we'll get back into in the second half of the show, is something so simple as the disposal of the waste, the manure, these lakes of manure seeping into the water supply and this kind of thing. I know you discussed this in the book as well.
Well, yeah. When you have the world today slaughters about 56 billion animals a year for food. Yeah. 56
billion?
56 billion, that's right.
Are you saying billion or million?
Billion.
Wow.
27 billion are slaughtered in the United States alone. So you can imagine, you're talking about the lagoons. Where's all this waste going to go? Is it just going to disappear into thin air? No. It has to go someplace. And the farmers store it in these huge mountains of dung, or they put it in these lagoons, and then when the lagoons turns to sludge, they take it out as manure and spread it over their fields. And they have so much of it that they spread it twice as thick as they need to. And this all seeps down into the groundwater, and it gets into our streams. It contaminates our rivers. And so that's what happens with the waste.
And I want people that are listening to know, if you are not already a vegetarian or vegan, and I know I drive this home almost every show, but I would like you to listen carefully, because if you're listening to this show, I'm certain that you care about this planet. And if you're still eating meat, I would hope that you would be open to understanding not only what this means to your body, but how not only what it means to the animals, because even though there are people that say that animals have no soul, I think we can agree that that is ridiculous, but also to the planet at large. So it's time to start. If you're not vegan yet or vegetarian, it's really time that you gave this some very serious consideration. When you think about 52 billion, was that what you said, David?
57.
57 billion animals a year. Try to imagine what all that waste means to the planet Earth. It's just outrageous.
Well, you know, Patricia, it's just going to get worse, because right now we have about 7.6 billion people on the Earth. Mm-hmm. This is going to increase to 9 billion within the next 35 years, and many of your listeners and many of us are going to be alive 35 years from now. And during that time, the meat production and dairy production is supposed to double. Now, presently, the United Nations estimates, put out a report, excuse me, that estimated that 38% of the entire ice-free land surface goes for livestock, for producing food for humans. Now, how much of the ice-free land surface is going to be used for livestock 35 years from now with a population of 9 billion? I mean, eventually we're going to have to put animals on the moon just to feed people to eat.
Do you think that the Earth can sustain 9 billion humans?
Well, a lot of people are looking at that, I think. hopefully so, or I mean, what's going to happen? More wars and everything to get rid of people?
Well, they're doing a great job of making sure that war never stops.
Yeah, that's for sure. That's for sure.
Well, it's a good question. I think that we really have to understand that the imbalance of human life on this planet is killing off. It's like somebody once said to me, Earth is humans are like a cancer. They kill off all the other life on the organism, which is a little bit negative, I would say, but still we are moving toward a point, a breaking point, where the human race is going to have to become more,
Well, I think we just need to be a lot more caring and compassionate than we are.
Yes.
And that's the big problem. It seems to me that we don't realize it. We really don't realize it. We grow up as children. We're in a certain way. We interact with the other children we know and our parents in the adult world, and we grow up and we think everything is normal. But really, what are we doing as we're growing up? Excuse me. As we're growing up, we're on a meat-based diet. That means whether we like it or not, we're participants in the cruelty that produces that meat. The clothing that we wear, it comes from animals and indirectly animal cruelty. The medicines that we use and the drugs that are produced come from animal cruelty. And we're really growing up, in many other ways that animals are used, we're really growing up in a way that's cruel. And it's cruelty based, and we don't even realize this. We don't recognize it. And
well, yeah, there's this disassociation. The way that food distribution is in this country, in on the planet, you go to the supermarket; it's all neatly wrapped, packed, and ready to go. And a lot of people never make the association that this is animal flesh from a live, breathing, a soul in an animal body. that feels just like we do. And I mean, I've had I cannot believe the number of people that tell me, you seriously don't think that cows feel the pain when they're killed.
Yes, isn't that amazing?
Why would you not think that? Well, because they're here for us. They're here for food for the human race. And my answer to that is, well, let's hope that the aliens that are about to arrive don't think that the human race is good food for them, or we're going to be in big trouble.
Well, let's hope that if the aliens come to Earth, the first place they head is for our animal research laboratories, and they find some willing subjects there.
You've written some pretty harrowing things in here about some of the things they're doing to the animals. What would you like my audience to know about that? I mean, we bleed when we hear the horror stories about what's done to these animals. But what do you feel is essential in bringing that information forward?
Well, in the book, I go into what happens on factory farms, and I go into what happens in animal research laboratories. They're both just horrendous. On factory farms, animals are mistreated from the time they're transported. Well, first of all, wherever they grow up, they either grow up on a factory farm, or they grow up on a farm, a domestic farm someplace, and they have to be transported to these factory farms. And this goes for all animals, for pigs, for cows, for chickens, for turkeys. And the method of transportation, for example, chickens, the way they transport chickens, they take them from these huge, like, tent-like structures, except they're not made out of tent material, but they're like that. They're just enormous. And the chickens grow up there. They live only about 45 days when they take them to slaughter. And to pack them there, workers called throwers, they just reach in and grab a handful by the feet, and they throw them through the air to a catcher, and the catcher catches them and just stuffs them in these crates. And this is, you know, about, they estimate that 95% of the animals suffer, of the chickens, suffer broken bones or dislocated bones in this process. And in the cages, some of them die and are underfoot of the other chickens. And then they take them to slaughter, and they hang them upside down on this conveyor belt that transports them along a line where there's a decapitating machine that's supposed to lop off their heads. But it doesn't get all of them, and so they're just dunked into scalding hot water alive.
Oh, God.
This happens to pigs, too. They kill pigs the same way. They suspend them from conveyor belts, and that transports them down the line. And they're squealing, terrified, and there's a man standing there with a knife. He sticks it, the knife, in the throat of the pigs and is supposed to kill them. But, of course, he's covered in blood, and his hand is slippery, and sometimes he missed, and sometimes the pigs manage to get out of the way of the knife, and they just keep transporting down the line until they get to these vats of scalding hot water that dunks them in there, fully alive, and you know, it's just a hellish, terrible system, the way we slaughter our animals.
I really, it's almost more than I can listen to. Off the track from what the questions I want to ask you about the book is a theoretical question, and that is, how can a human being reach that level of insensitivity? I know this is a theoretical question, but... what kind of person does that kind of work?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning of the show these two boys who held this dog that they had just hung. And I heard just the other day a story of a man in China who took a puppy at the ocean, and he threw it out in the ocean. And the puppy swam back to shore, and he got it, and he threw it back in the ocean. And he did this five times, trying to drown the dog. And finally, somebody intervened, and a woman came up and took the dog, and she gave it to somebody who said that they would take care of it. And so you do ask yourself, what kind of person is this that will do something like this? And I ask the same question about animal researchers. What kind of these are very intelligent, sophisticated people, and yet they get in there and they do this kind of animal research, and you ask, how can they be so insensitive? But they are. I just think it's a matter of conditioning, and I think it's a matter of going along with what everybody else is doing, not having a questioning mind, not having a caring type of inner being, and just, I don't know. It's a hard question to answer.
Yeah, it is. I would say that also that they're not just insensitive. Many of them enjoy the inflicting that pain, like these two kids that I referred to earlier. And I'm sure you'll agree that meat eaters, well, I better not, I'm not going to say what I was going to say because I don't want to offend anyone. But I would think that the vegetarians and vegans have, by distancing themselves from ingesting all that blood, I think there's a biological aspect to them being able to raise their sensitivity to the problem. Would you agree with that?
Not only would I agree with that, I wish somebody would do a study on that, because that could be very important information. I mean, they say that vegans, that there's an upgrade in their intelligence when people go vegan. And to me, that's quite possible, but I'd like to see it somebody study it and really show that scientifically.
Maybe you could do that, considering your qualifications.
Well, I'm afraid that I'm not too much in the area of scientific studies.
All right, let's talk about specific information that you bring forward in the book with regard to meat eating and disease. One of them that you refer to is Alzheimer's. Can you tell us a little bit about what your findings are about the relationship between meat eating and the development of Alzheimer's disease?
Well, like many diseases, Alzheimer's has been connected. Several studies have been done, that's all. Several studies have been done showing a direct correlation between eating meat to getting Alzheimer's disease. I list several of these studies in the book. So it does seem like Alzheimer's could be prevented if we stop consuming meat.
What would you make of that? Would you think that it's because of all the fats from the meat that are... I have no idea. I don't know very much about Alzheimer's. So do you discuss this in the book? What aspect of eating meat would contribute to developing that disease?
I think it's... I'm not sure. I'm not really sure the answer to that question. I just think it would probably come from the fats, but just the animal protein itself is the cause of these problems. It's carcinogenic, and it causes heart disease. And if you go into something like breast cancer, for example, there I can give you the biological cause. I can't do that with Alzheimer's because I don't.
Okay, well, let's talk about that. What is the correlation between the meat consumption and the cancer, the breast cancer?
It comes from estrogen. And over 70% of breast cancers are estrogen-related. That's because breast tumors depend on estrogen to grow. And this is a well-known fact because the treatment for breast cancer, one of the main treatments for breast cancer, is estrogen-lowering drugs like tamoxifen, which is one of the favorite ones they use. And in this connection, you know, it's curious how our healthcare organizations, like the National Cancer Institute, for example, won't admit that animal protein or fats have anything to do with getting breast cancer. They say, in fact, that a diet that's low in fat and high in vegetable and fruits, there's no evidence showing that that reduces the risk of breast cancer. But there is evidence that shows that. And scientists like T. Colin Campbell, for example, says the exact opposite. He says that a diet that's high in fats and animal protein and low in fiber, which means low in plant-based foods, is a high-risk factor for getting breast cancer. Now, you take the take a foundation like the Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation, Susan G. Komen for People for the Cure, they're called, I believe, Susan G. Komen for the Cure. And they even advise women who are at high risk of breast cancer that they might want to consider taking tamoxifen because it lowers estrogen blood levels. Yet they won't tell people that you can lower your estrogen levels if you stop consuming animal protein. And if women did this, and millions of women could be saved getting breast cancer if they knew this information. But our healthcare organizations, like the National Cancer Institute, like the American Cancer Society, like the Susan G. Komen People for the Cure, will not tell this information to women. Look, if you avoid animal protein, you can vastly reduce your risk of getting breast cancer. And women go to such extremes to avoid getting breast cancer, they'll have both breasts removed in something called prophylactic mastectomy. And when I heard about that, I was just amazed. Here you can reduce your estrogen levels by eliminating animal protein from the diet, and you can reduce your risk of getting breast cancer. So what I would like to frankly see, and you tell me how you feel about this, I would like to see women get on the case of these healthcare organizations and say, look, you can believe if you, all you want, you can believe that scientists like T. Colin Campbell are quacks when they say that eliminating animal protein will reduce your breast cancer, but at least tell both sides of the story. You're only telling one side of the story, and therefore you're preventing women from getting this information. You're not doing your job. It's your responsibility to tell both sides of the story.
Right, but I think we'll agree that we can't depend on government organizations for the true story on a lot of things, certainly not on health and well-being, considering how the drug lobby runs the Congress.
Right, exactly.
So, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me that the government wants people to be sick. So it's going to take people getting, like you say, taking care of their own health from here on in and informing themselves by reading books like yours.
Well, you know, there's another link, too, talking about the government and the role that they play in this and helping people along to get disease. And that's our healthcare organizations are bound by all these conflicts of interest. Like, for example, with the drug companies. Bristol-Myers Squibb gave the American Heart Association $600,000 in order to use the American Heart Association logo to promote their drug Pravacol, which is a statin. Now, statins, there's a lot of evidence that statins are not as effective as they're supposed to be. There's evidence that shows that women who take, and statins is, for people who aren't aware of it, is a drug that's used to lower cholesterol levels to help prevent heart disease. And there's evidence to show that statins are not nearly as effective as they would like us to believe. Some women who take them get more heart attacks. And there's evidence showing that people who take statins, unless they've already had diabetes or a heart attack and are over the age of 65, are not protected by statins. So this isn't the kind of information that an organization like the American Heart Association should be communicating to the public. But are they going to do that if they take $600,000 from Bristol-Myers Squibb? I don't think so.
No, I don't either.
Right. And there are a lot of incidents like this.
Sorry, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, like the American Cancer Society, for example, got a grant of $1.7 million from Pfizer. Pfizer just gave it to them. You know, like, we're these good guys. We're such good people. We're going to give the American Cancer Society $1.7 million so that they'll help us prevent cancer. Meanwhile, Pfizer makes all kinds of drugs, including cancer drugs. They make drugs for breast cancer. Now, after they get $1.7 million, is the American Cancer Society going to go out and say, look, you should stop consuming animal protein, because if you do, you'll reduce your estrogen levels and you'll reduce your risk of getting breast cancer? Are they going to say that when they just got $1.7 million from Pfizer? And if people do reduce their breast cancer risk, this is going to take money away from Pfizer. So these conflicts of interest, as far as I'm concerned, they just should be totally prohibited by law. I mean, how can our healthcare organizations function independently of outside influences and report the truth to the people if these kinds of conflicts of interest are going on? They just can't.
So it would appear to me at the moment that the intention is not that they act independently, and that all of these, the Obamacare program in these states and also here in Europe, are intended to have a... you're supposed to sell the drugs. I mean, I had a doctor once back in the States, and he said to me, you know, Patricia, I'm thinking about just getting out of it. I'm just ready to retire, because he said, what's coming for the population is just a bunch of pill pushers. That's what they want us to do. Just give you the pills and get you out the door. And
right.
It's going to take a lot of human consciousness for people to start understanding that they're going to have to address their well-being on their own, and with the help of organizations that are working to bring that information forward, which brings me to another point. You may have heard that the police charged into the Whole Foods store. I think it was in Los Angeles. Did you hear about this?
No, what's that?
There was a man running a raw food, health food store, Whole Foods, I believe it was called, and three police came in with automatic weapons, and he had to be, they threw him up against the wall, and they threw the vegetables and food around. He said he was no longer going to be allowed to sell this food. It was against the law.
Well,
and this is happening more and more. I just read an article where I think it's Michigan is going to outlaw. I don't want to quote myself and be incorrect, but it was about lemon trees being against the law for some reason. And more information is coming out about people not being allowed to grow food on their land. And it's very clear that there is a rising governmental intention to turn off the valves on all of our alternative food. In fact, the Codex Alimentarius, which I discussed, I think the last time I was on the air, is making it illegal for us to get natural supplements. What do you have to say about that?
The corporations are trying to take over. They want to rule everything and control everything. I mean, another thing is this Animal Enterprise Terrorist Act, the AETA, which they've passed. You know, they want to make it illegal to criticize the meat industry, for example, and they want to make it a terrorist act. They arrested and tried to prosecute four people just because they wore a mask on their face and were writing in chalk and sidewalk against animal research that was going on in Los Angeles. And that case got thrown out, but only because the government had insufficient evidence and The judge said, if you find evidence, you can bring the case back and start it over again. And they just want to control everything. They want to take away the people's rights, and they want to have a corporate control of the world, of the economy.
Yeah, and the food supply.
And the food supply, yes.
In a paragraph in your book, you say that even the American Medical Association claimed that grains, fruits, vegetables, and legumes were, on a quote, irresponsible and potentially dangerous to the health and welfare of Americans, unquote. And you obviously add that meat and dairy products clearly are not in that group. And that is a pretty shocking thing, that that such blatant behaviors on the part of these organizations to come out and say things like that makes it very clear that this is a war on your sovereignty.
Right. That was another of these conflicts of interest. The Beef Industry Council was also involved in that. And it started out because the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine recommended that we should have a new four foods group that excluded meat and dairy products, and the new four food group should be consist of grains, vegetables, fruits, and legumes. And this is what this was about. The AMA criticized the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine for putting forward this idea. And it turned out that they had a direct connection to the Beef Industry Council, and the Beef Industry Council came out and said they were silent. They didn't criticize the Physicians Committee, and they said later that they were silent because the American Medical Association was doing such a good job and that they were acting on their behalf. So it's again this conflict of interest.
What about dairy? Some people that are not non-vegetarians but not vegans, what can you tell us about dairy and its effect on women, for starters? You mentioned osteoporosis. And I'd like to know if the estrogens are also in the dairy and what you have to say about its relationship to cancer as well.
Well, dairy foods have been linked to breast cancer. And for osteoporosis, the dairy industry tells us that we need huge volumes of calcium to counteract thinning bones or osteoporosis. But what really happens when you take too much calcium, the calcium gets excreted. And this is a process that's been known for a long time. What happens is that when you take in too much calcium, it increases the metabolic acid in the body, which causes the bones to bleed out the calcium, which then gets excreted. So that's why, though the dairy industry gets everybody to believe their side that you need huge amounts of calcium, really, the more calcium you take in, the worse it is for you, and this is why vegans who consume much less calcium don't have such a problem with osteoporosis, because they don't consume as much calcium, and therefore they're not excreting as much in their urine, and so they just don't get as much osteoporosis.
You said it was bleeding out from the bones. Did I hear that right?
Yes, that's right. It extracts it. The metabolic acid has the effect of extracting it from the bones.
So, as you say, the act of drinking or bringing calcium into the body in such a volume creates that opposite effect of depleting the body.
Yes, that's right.
Well, that's good to know.
Yeah, this is brought forward. For example, Mark Hegstead, who's a retired professor from Harvard University, makes this point, as do other people like T. Colin Campbell and Dean Ornish, and some physicians and doctors are trying to get this information out there, but they're just overwhelmed by the dairy industry, and everybody has bought into this. Now, when right now there's some legislation before Congress to try to change the food that's being offered in our school lunch programs. But when everything is finally said and done, the Institute of Medicine is going to be making the recommendations, and they buy into this idea that we need all this calcium and all these dairy products, and they're going to be recommending this for the children. And so the children are going to pick up these habits, and they're going to carry through them until they're adults. And then a lot of them are going to end up with osteoporosis as a result.
At the very least.
At the very least, you're right.
Because the meat, the so-called meat products that the children are eating are not even meat. Let's not even talk about the junk food scenario, but it's just frightening what these little children are eating.
That's right. That's right.
You know, I'm sure you've seen the Happy Burger information where this person has been has held a McDonald's burger for like one for 4 years, one for 3 years, etc., and they don't decay, they don't break down.
Right. Yeah, I have. I've heard about that, yeah.
Yeah, and he had it in his pocket apparently and forgot it, and he went back to his jacket three weeks later, and it was exactly the same as it was when he put it in the pocket.
That's
yikes.
Amazing. Imagine putting this in your body.
No, I can't. I have to say, not that I'm a holier-than-thou type, but I have maybe had one McDonald's experience in my life as a younger person, and that was enough.
Well,
younger, not wiser.
I can't say that because I went vegan pretty late in life, but so for a number of years I did consume meat, which I regret very much. But so far I've escaped its effects.
Yeah, I did eat meat too. I was just referring to the junk food burger routine that I've managed to avoid pretty much in my life. I wanted to ask you to talk about the grain, because cows naturally should be grazing, but we know that in these farms, these factory farms, they're fed grain for so many obvious reasons. One is because there's not as much land needed and required, and the other is to control their eating so that they get bigger faster, and we all know that score. But what can you tell us about what's really being fed to these animals and the toxicity in their food and their feed?
Well, they're being fed coarse grains, and the grain, and they should be out obviously eating grass and shrubbery and roots and things like that. That's what their nature intended them to be eating. But they're feeding them these coarse grains because that way they can confine them and they don't have to feed them grass and shrubbery, and they can confine them in small spaces. But confined in these small spaces, they get a lot of diseases, and this grain produces a lot of fat, and then they give them antibiotics and growth hormone, and it creates a very disease-laden condition for the animals.
It's called bovine growth hormone, right?
Bovine growth hormone is something they inject in them to control other conditions that they're getting from eating these grains.
So, of course, we're eating that. Meat eaters are ingesting that as well. What is the effect, you think, on the human body ingesting meat that has been completely saturated with all of these chemicals and hormones?
Well, I didn't go into that in the animal protein. A person who covers that topic pretty well is Samuel Epstein, and he's written several books on the subject, including one book called What's in Your Milk? And he goes into growth hormones and really what the farmers are doing to the cows. Another very good source for that is Howard Lyman, who wrote the book Mad Cowboy. And Howard was a farmer who was completely caught up and believed totally in the way we produce food on factory farms, and he developed his own cattle, which he raised, and he built a huge business. And then he got terribly sick from it himself, and so he stopped and turned around. And he's written about this, too, very effectively. That's L-Y-M-A-N, Howard Lyman.
Okay, Howard Lyman, and you can check that out at the end of the show if you're interested in finding out more about that. And when we had the mad cow disease scare, is it true, that, to your knowledge, that they were actually, well, they were reprocessing dead or diseased cows back into the food, and that's why they got sick?
I really don't know very much about that, but I've heard similar stories. But I don't know if that's true or not. It doesn't surprise me at all that they would do something like that.
How did you get involved in animal rights?
Well, actually, when was it? About 1981, thereabouts, I took in a couple of cats to live with me. And just observing these cats and how they lived and how they interacted and just seeing how they had their own special lives that they were leading, how their lives were important to them too. And we tend to grow up, we think, oh, well, the lives of other animals, like you were talking about a little while ago, the lives of other animals aren't important. What they do doesn't mean anything. They're just objects. But they're not. And they really have... Their lives are important to them as our lives are important to us. And this is something that we don't recognize, but I began to recognize it by living with my cats. And as I grew to love them and care for them, it became obvious that, you know, I mean, some people have household animals, their companion animals, and they have no problem then going out and eat other animals. But to me, I couldn't go out and eat my cats, so how could I go out and eat other animals? And this kind of growing awareness like this, that plus the fact that I had a friend, I was working then at Columbia University, and I made a friend of a woman who had come to Columbia to study, and she was from Alabama. And she used to kid me about my liberal ideas, and she wasn't nearly as liberal as I was. And then suddenly, out of the clear blue sky, she turned vegan. And then she said to me, "Now who's the big liberal, you or me?" And so she was right. And that combined with my growing experience of living with my animals and learning to really start to care about animals and trying to understand them more, that's when I became vegan.
I think that one of the greatest things that a parent can do is to let their children have pets so that they can become sensitized to the consciousness in the animals, apart from the love and the joy and the fun of having pets in the home, that this would be a way for children to hopefully grow up into conscious adults who will respect the animal kingdom and will nurture them.
I agree.
You said you worked at Columbia University. You know, I don't think that people realize that the universities are in many ways the centers of all these animal research studies, and they're funded by the government very often. And I'd like to talk about the morality, let's say, the moral structure of those research programs being conducted in our universities. What can you tell us about that?
Well, yeah, that's a great subject. First, let me just say that the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, gives out about approximately $20 billion a year to our universities and healthcare centers to conduct animal research. Now, they won't tell us exactly how much they give, even though it's a federal organization funded by our tax dollars. They won't tell that. But independent sources have put it together, and they estimate that that's how much money they spend. They give our universities huge amounts of money. Harvard University gets $400 million a year.
Yikes.
Michigan University gets over about $250. Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia, gets about $250 million. So this is big business. And the universities develop these animal research laboratories where they conduct research. And in the book, The Protein Myth, I divided into two categories. One is a group of scientists that really are in earnest in trying to find cures for disease. That can't be denied. Of course, I disagree with them still. But it can't be denied that they are serious. And the other side is a group that are just kind of going along, and all they're doing is creating all these fake research projects just to try to get billions of dollars. And one of the most reprehensible, immoral aspects of animal testing, which our universities are involved in, is addiction animal testing. Drug addiction, alcohol addiction, and smoking. Now, our universities pride themselves in how moral they are. They look back to the Greek and all the philosophers, and they blazon the philosophers' names across their universities, and it's a sign of how intellectual and how moral they are. Well, how come then they're doing this addiction drug testing? Because cannot anybody see that to force animals to pay for the mistakes that human beings make in becoming in using drugs, alcohol, and tobacco, should animals pay for that? No, that's just plainly wrong and just plainly immoral. Some of the research projects these researchers invent, like there's a guy at he has a doctorate from Harvard in medicine, and he has a PhD from MIT, and he conducts these kind of experiments at the Oregon Health and Science University. And there he uses animals like he uses apes, and he implants nicotine pumps, that's it. Nicotine pumps in their backs three times during their enforced pregnancies. And I'm trying to remember if they're chimpanzees or gorillas. But anyway, he forces them, he surgically implants these nicotine pumps in their backs. Then once they give birth to the babies, they reach into the cage when the babies are nursing. They grab the babies through the bars of the cages and take them away, and the mothers just suffer tremendously from the loss of their babies. And it's these kind of experiments that are going on all the time in animal research laboratories that are really immoral.
Can't stand to hear it, I'll tell you. We've been talking, it's already the end of the hour. Oh, I don't want to leave with a heavy heart. So before I say goodbye and thank you to David, I would like to remind you and thank you all for being so generous in my Whale Warrior campaign for the Sea Shepherd. It's amazing what you've done. I set a goal for $6,000 of contributions to them, and I'm about $160 short. So if you can help me help make that goal for them, you can find the link to my Sea Shepherd page on their website, at my website at SyrianRevelations.net. And let us, painful what we've heard today, but hopefully this will help motivate us even more to make a difference out there and to help people understand that being human is about loving all beings on this planet and loving the planet herself. So I've been talking today with David Giroux Irving. His book, you really want to read this book. It's something you're going to want in your library. It's called The Protein Myth. And David, what is your website?
That's theproteinmyth1.com, the number one.
Theproteinmythnumber1.com. I really suggest that you give this some thought. I'm sorry. I know it's very hard to listen to the torture of anyone or anything, but we need to hear it, as I said, so that we can be activated to do something about it and to think about what we're doing as individuals to perpetuate these abuses. Think about your makeup. Think about your food. Think about all of these aspects and start making the choices that will prevent a mama ape being tortured in that way and then having her baby taken away so that she can be pumped up with more nicotine. Sigh. All right, I'm going to leave on an up note. Thank you, David. You're doing great work. I'm really grateful that you came on. I hope you'll come back on sometime soon.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks very much for having me.
Thank you. All right, everybody, this is Patricia Corey. You've been listening to Beyond the Matrix. Keep soaring high above this matrix, bringing truth, soaring with the eagles, and freeing your soul. I will have the amazing Laura Eisenhower, great-granddaughter to President Eisenhower, on my show in 2 weeks, and we're going to blow the lid on the Mars Project. You know that's one of my favorite subjects. So tune in 2 weeks from now and join me in a really exciting show. Thanks, everybody. This is Patricia Corey, signing out.